It's the Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and I like to think I choose what I eat. But the University of California says, no way. Habit makes the choice. Now, they put movie popcorn lovers in a theater. Half got bags of fresh popcorn, half got week-old popcorn. And by the end of the film, all the popcorn was gone, stale or not. Next, the same people with the same two types of popcorn went into a conference room. Nowhere near as much of the stale stuff was eaten. It turns out if you put us in a new environment, we notice what we eat. So, I'm eating in my garage. Well, there's more coming up this hour on the Splendid Table. This is the Splendid Table from APM American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Anyone told you that you control your food just like an emerald wasp does? Probably not, but if they did, it's quite a compliment. Now, you might not get this if you haven't met Marlene Zook. She's a lifelong lover of insects, which led to her becoming a biology professor at the University of California at Riverside. And now she's written Sex on Six Legs, Lessons on Life, Love, and Language from the Insect World. Marlene, good to have you with us. Welcome.
It's great to be on the show.
I'd like to begin with a quote that you have near the open of the book. Insects show that it's possible to be unselfish without a moral code, sophisticated without education, and beautiful with a skeleton on the outside. So how do they do these things?
Insects are remarkable in part because there's so many of them that they've been able to demonstrate all the different solutions that evolution's come up with to the same problem. Everything that's alive has, including people, has the same problems. We all need to reproduce and we need to survive long enough to do it. And what that means is that everything all of us do amounts at some point to either food or sex. But they do all of this in vastly different ways than people do because they've got tiny brains, tiny bodies, and they just don't have the kind of sophisticated ability to think that we do. They're operating on the basis of often just a handful of genetic instructions, and yet they're capable of performing incredibly complicated behaviors.
Talk to me about their function in food.
Well, insects are central to food for humans in a lot of ways. Probably the most obvious one that people think about is pollination. Honeybees are the most obvious example, but there's lots of others. We need insects to pollinate crops, to pollinate flowers for fruit and nuts, things like almonds. The almond crop in California is enormously economically important and relies on honeybees. So we need them for things to supply our food. We also need them to actually make food for us, things like honey. But more than that, insects are kind of this unseen master force beneath it all, where they process waste in the environment. They ensure that forest debris gets eaten up so that it doesn't just sit there, so that it becomes part of the mulch. They aerate the soil. They do all these things that enable us to have a world with plants in it because the plants often rely on insects. And of course, they control some kinds of plants because they eat plants. They also eat other insects that can be more seen as pests and so forth. So they're really central yet unseen to an awful lot of what we eat, even though I know the average gardener just thinks of them as being, you know, stuff that's going to get your tomatoes.
Yeah, insect seems to be a synonym for pest for a lot of people.
And yet most insects, the vast, vast, vast majority of insects are not pests. Even cockroaches, which are so reviled by people, have a plus side. I don't often have success with this, but you know, you really can think of cockroaches as being just regular, lovely, attractive insects, blameless, going off doing their own thing. only a very small handful of the approximately 8,000 species of cockroaches are actually household pests. The rest of them are, some of them are very beautiful. They have lovely colors. Some of them have really interesting behaviors. There are actually monogamous cockroaches that live in little family groups with the mother cockroach and the father cockroach. Yeah, see, isn't that cute? And the baby cockroaches. you know, I have to confess that even I don't usually have a lot of luck in promoting this to people, but it's true.
You know, another thing that intrigued me in the book was how insects feed themselves. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Insects get their own food in just about every way you can imagine, and in pretty much all the ways that humans do, and then some. Some insects actually are farmers. There are ants that cut off pieces of leaf, use that as a kind of soil, and grow mushrooms on it, which they then eat. There are also insects, of course, that eat plants, insects that eat each other, and insects that eat each other, but they do it in a way that I think most humans would find a little grisly.
For instance?
Well, so going back to the cockroaches, there's a kind of wasp called an emerald jewel wasp that actually paralyzes its prey so that it can carry it to a place where it can be used to feed the offspring. So emerald jewel wasps eat cockroaches, which is probably happy news for a lot of people. But the problem with eating cockroaches is that you can't just pick them up because they're many times bigger than you are if you're an emerald jewel wasp. What the jewel wasp does instead is sting the cockroach in such a way that the cockroach is kind of paralyzed but zombie-like, still able to move and walk, but unable to control its own body. So what the wasp does is take the antenna of the cockroach and lead it along as though she's walking a dog on a leash, and walk it all the way over to where she's laid her eggs. That way, her offspring have kind of a pre-preserved source of food, but the cockroach can't get away.
That's pretty stunning. You know, there's one vivid image in the book that stayed with me of you standing in Hawaii at night watching silent crickets move across a lawn.
Oh, now that, of course, is my favorite story because the insects that I work on are crickets, and that's another one of these grisly stories that people seem to like so much. So crickets call, of course, to get mates. That's what males do. But at least in parts of Hawaii, when they do that, they also attract the attention of a parasitic insect, a fly. When the parasite hears the cricket calling, she flies over to the cricket, deposits her larvae on and around it, and then the larvae burrow into the body of the cricket and develop inside the cricket while he's still alive. So again, it's one of these zombie kind of stories where he looks like a cricket from the outside, he walks like a cricket, he, you know, talks like a cricket, or at least sings like a cricket, but inside he's being increasingly taken over by the, you know, munching jaws of this fly maggot. And eventually the fly bursts out and goes into the soil and becomes an adult fly, and the cricket dies. But the fly's been using the cricket for about a week or so as kind of a living food source.
Yes, it is gruesome.
I've always said if these things were the size of fox terriers, you know, no one would ever sleep at night.
That's a very good point. Marlene, thank you for talking with us.
This has been a lot of fun. Thanks so much.
Biology professor Marlene Zook is author of Sex on Six Legs, Lessons on Life, Love, and Language from the Insect World. Well, Australia has a new cocktail, and it will probably be at a bar near us soon. It's called Absolute Tune, and it's a mix of vodka and Sauvignon Blanc, and it has bubbles. Now, personally, I do not think this sounds like a winner. Absolute's press release is a gem of doublespeak. This is a quote. "The first taste of Absolute Tune reveals vibrant, fresh tropical fruits with a balanced sweetness through the front and mid palate, which is brought to life through the bubbles. And with a persistent medium strength Absolute vodka flavor and balanced sweetness leading on to a dry finish." And if you're still awake, yes, that was one sentence. A report on focus groups said that in a month of pouring this in three bars, not one single person would talk to the press. Hmm. Don't you love it when people blithely say, eat more vegetables, cook with the seasons? Sure, except how will you get the time and who's going to convince your family to eat those vegetables? Well, Melissa Clark is in the same boat, even though she's a food writer. She works full time. She has a family that can be picky. But she has some solutions in her book, Cook This Now, 120 easy and delectable dishes that you can't wait to make. Melissa, welcome.
Oh, thanks, Lynn. Great to be here.
So how do you get your family eating vegetables?
Well, this is the thing that I've really noticed as I've been cooking more seasonally. And, you know, especially in the fall when the harvest comes in and you have all these great vegetables available from the farmer's market, is that it's easier to get people to eat them when they are at their freshest because they taste better. So when I find Brussels sprouts that are just so sweet because you're buying them right after the first frost, and I cook them with, and this is the important thing, a lot of oil, a lot of fat, a lot of butter, a lot of salt, delicious things to make vegetables taste so good.
I think that when people hear a lot of fat, alarms start
you don't have to use a lot. It's about using enough, because what I found with vegetables is, first of all, if you don't have fat with vegetables, you're not getting as much of the vitamins. You know, you really do need a little bit of fat to be able to fully digest everything. So you can be moderate about it, but we have to use really good, you know, good quality fats. Amazing olive oil, like dark green, fragrant olive oil. When you put that on raw kale, have you ever done a raw kale salad?
No.
It's one of my favorite things in the world to eat. You know, if you get kale that's very fresh and you slice it really thin, it sort of melts in the mouth if you add a lot of olive oil and salt, and it wilts a little bit in the bowl. And then when you serve it, I mean, first of all, any vegetable that you can serve raw, if it tastes delicious, it's amazing for you. But people think, they don't know what it is. You know, they think, oh my goodness, what is this flavor? It just tastes like green. It just tastes like fresh. It just tastes so bright. And, you know, in the winter when you're eating rich, heavy meats, you want something very bright to go along with it. So it's a perfect thing for roast chicken or for a little bit of for roast beef maybe, or if you have a stew, it works really well. Another one of my favorites is roasted cauliflower and roasted broccoli. I think most people think cauliflower and broccoli, they steam them, or maybe they would saute them with garlic, which is also delicious. But when you roast these vegetables, the edges get caramelized. The interior stays very, very, you know, it gets very soft and very, very almost juicy. And then I like to use spices as well, because spices really help bring out the flavor of when you have sort of a, let's say, an assertive flavored vegetable like a cauliflower or a broccoli. Mm-hmm. If you add cumin or coriander, it works really well with the strong flavors. It kind of mellows them and everything just gets golden brown and so soft. And again, when you're making something that is so good, it's not a hard sell.
So you find that your daughter likes these?
She will eat it. Well, you know, that's another thing about three-year-olds. They're kind of moody. So I will say 90% of the time, I swear, 90% of the time, she will eat especially the sweeter things. You know, I mean, yes, she'll eat the broccoli. She'll eat cauliflower when I roast them. The pumpkin and the sweet potatoes, again, you know, fall vegetables, like those you don't even need to sell to your family. Everyone just gobbles those up because they taste so good. And I like to enhance their sweetness if you accentuate it by using a little bit of brown sugar, maple syrup, a few drops of honey is amazing with these vegetables. And then on the other side of it, if you want to take it into a more savory direction, lemon zest, orange zest, herb sprigs like thyme sprigs, bay leaves, a little bit of crushed garlic, or one of my favorite things to do is to add chili powder. Just a touch of chili powder with the sweetness of, say, maple syrup or honey. Oh my God, that is really one of the most delicious combinations. The sweet, the mellow vegetable, and then the spicy chili.
Melissa, I think you've built a new vegetable fan club. Thank you.
Oh, thanks, Lynn.
Melissa Clark's latest book is Cook This Now. Try her recipe for cinnamon roasted sweet potatoes and garlic. You can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're on the site, check out our podcasts, recipes, our e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and register for our monthly cookbook giveaway. This month, the book is our new cookbook, How to Eat Weekends. We also have started a series of How to Eat Weekends podcasts and a blog of the same name. And it's all there, splendidtable.org. We'll be back with Radical Home Ec and a look at a new coffee hotspot, Iowa. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Remember the days of home ec? The aprons, the sewing, the knitting, the cake baking? Well, sophomores may no longer have to fulfill that requirement in high school, but there are plenty of people putting a modern spin on home ec. We're looking at the stuff in our cupboards and our lives and are seriously reconsidering the hows and whys of what's there. Kelly Coyne and her husband Eric Knudsen are at the front of the pack with their new book, Making It, Radical Home Ec for a Post-Consumer World. Kelly, Eric, good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
Hi, Lynn.
So, radical home ec. What is home ec for the two of you, and what's radical about it?
Well, home ec for the two of us is about taking things to their roots, and that's what the word radical actually means. And the broader philosophy that we have is that we're trying to make our home a locus of production rather than consumption.
Did this begin in a particular way for you two, or have you always thought this way?
It started with those tomatoes on the porch, I think, in our apartment.
We always go back to that story, how we wanted a tomato that tasted like something very badly. So even though we lived in an apartment, we started growing them on our back porch. And then once we bought our house and had space, then things started to aggregate like a coral reef, one project after another, one vegetable bed after another. It's just sort of built up and surprised us over time.
And then it kind of got out of control. Then came the chickens. Then came the bees. Then came thinking
the
about
the ferrets and the llamas and the.
Are you serious?
No.
All right. Okay. Just wondering about the llamas now, because you two live in Los Angeles, right, in the city.
Yes, in the center of the city.
And the remarkable thing about Los Angeles is that we actually do have some space here, so you could conceivably keep llamas in Los Angeles. But it is perfectly easy in our backyard to have a few chickens and to have two beehives. That's the wonderful thing about Los Angeles and a climate that you can grow things year-round.
Is there some orneriness behind all of this, some anti-establishment, you know, philosophy at work here?
Well, people always ask us that, and not really. I actually go back to my favorite Stoic philosophers who said there are some things you can control in life and some things you can't. And you worry about the things that you can control. And that's what home economics is. That's the things that are within our household that are within our power to change. And we make those changes in the household and in our personal lives, and those effects ripple outwards into the neighborhood, into the community. And that's our orneriness. It's not political. It's not left or right. It's something that everyone can get into.
If anything, it makes us less ornery because it gives us something to focus on, something that's positive, and makes us more content and happy.
How do you find the time for this?
Well, we always tell people not to do everything in our book because we're insane. But, you know, it's just one project, one symbolic change is enough. You know, just cooking from scratch one night a week, something like that. I mean, I'm not above heating something up in the microwave when I don't have enough time. But just those simple changes every once in a while can have a profound effect.
And again, we've developed this stuff. Like I said, it's aggregated over 15 years. And so if you come to our house, you say, oh, look at all that stuff. But that was all one project at a time. We always say follow your passion. Choose something that really appeals to you. If you're not into vegetable gardening, there's no need for you to force yourself to do it. Find something that appeals to you on a gut level, like beer. Beer appeals to many people on a gut level. You know, go ahead and learn to make beer. Just do one thing. And you'll find over time that doing one thing engenders more things.
You know, I'm looking. I made a rough list of some of the things I found in the book because your range is pretty stunning. How to make beer, how to make styling gel, how to kill a chicken, one bowl meals, and how to grow your own shampoo. I have to ask you this. How do you grow your own shampoo?
Oh, that's soapwort. There's a wonderful herb called soapwort, which grows wild in many parts of the country, not out here where it's real dry, but I bet maybe you could find it out where you are, Lynn. And it also easily is grown from seed. It would naturalize in your garden and perhaps try to take it over. It's a pretty little low-growing plant with flowers on it. And you just harvest it either fresh or dry and boil it in water, basically. And you make a sort of a thin liquid that is a very gentle cleanser. And actually, it's a historical cleanser. And to this day, museums use it to clean their fine linen collections.
Really?
Their historical ancient linens, because it's that gentle. And it's really a very nice shampoo. So
I could grow it in the summer. It sounds like a weed. Right?
It's almost a weed.
But you could dry this and then keep it through the winter and make
exactly.
it and just moisten it and you have a shampoo.
Exactly. You can buy it online dry as well and they'll mail it to you and you can experiment with it and see if you want to grow it.
So the basic goal you have here is to what? Be completely independent of commerce, you know, of having to go out and spend money?
No, I kind of like spending money sometimes. Eric hates spending money, but yeah, you know. But no, I don't think we want to be completely independent of commerce. So we live in Los Angeles and we choose, you know, we could have chosen to move out into the country where we were never tempted. But we like to be, you know, around all this life and temptation of the big city.
I think one of the things is not to shop for the sake of shopping. Certainly, you need to buy things, but recreational shopping isn't such a good thing. And we hope that by taking things back to their roots, we can get to the essence of things.
Yeah, we find more contentment in making something than buying it generally. Not just contentment, but pleasure of discovery. We're both people who love to learn and discover, and every time we take on a new project, it involves learning a whole new knowledge set, you know, learning about basic chemistry or the habits of bees or the weeds of Southern California or whatever it is. We just keep learning. And I think we've discovered a way to make our home a university.
Thank you both for talking with us.
Thank you, Lynn.
Kelly Coyne and Eric Knutson wrote Making It, Radical Home Ec for a Post-Consumer World. Now, I recommend their recipe for homemade mustard. You can customize it with spices or honey. You can find the recipe for mustard on the website, splendidtable.org. That overused expression, good, honest food, well, it does apply to what Jane and Michael Stern post on their website, roadfood.com, and what they talk about here every week. Jane, Michael, good to have you back.
Great to be here.
Hi, Lynn.
So what have you guys been up to? What's the latest?
We have been eating and drinking coffee all through Iowa. And when I say drinking coffee, you have to realize that in Iowa and in a lot of the Midwest in particular, coffee isn't just a side dish. It's a real social beverage. You know this when you walk into a town cafe and there's a pegboard. And on that pegboard are maybe several dozen different kinds of coffee cups, each one belonging to a specific patron of the cafe who will walk in and not sit down and wait for a waitress to come. He'll walk in, take his cup off the shelf, go to the coffee maker, pour some coffee for himself, then go sit down with his buddies or perhaps his family and drink not just one or three or five cups of coffee, but maybe even 10, because this is coffee that is made to be drunk.
This is the coffee that they drink in the Midwest, and they drink it all
by
day
the gallon
long. Michael and I, of course, poured our own coffee in somebody else's coffee cup, and it looked like brown water.
If you're expecting espresso, you will be disappointed.
There is a sign that said, "Do not make fun of our coffee. One day you will be old and weak too."
Yeah, it's kind of like a spritzer. You know, you're not going to get a full dose of caffeine by drinking it. It's a social beverage.
So where did you go for this kind of coffee?
The small town of Stanton, Iowa. You'll know you're arriving at Stanton, Iowa, because above the town is a gigantic water tower that is in the shape of a pot of coffee. Somewhere below that water tower is a small cafe called Susie's Kitchen. Now, Susie is best known for her delicious pies, but she also makes a wonderful cup of that really clear, delicious, what's known as Swedish coffee that you can drink by the gallon and keep drinking.
So what makes it Swedish, Michael?
They've got a trick. What they do is they take one whole egg, a raw egg, and break it into a pint of coffee, of ground coffee, mix it up so the ground coffee gets a little moist, and then boil it. And what happens is that egg kind of clarifies the brew, and what you get is something very unlike an inky espresso. It's sort of the opposite. It's very clear and refreshing, the kind of coffee that you can sit down with your friends and drink for hours and keep enjoying it.
And you don't walk out of the place with your eyeballs spinning.
No.
This may be the glue that's held together rural America.
I would put it in the present tense. It's still very much happening.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, guys, thank you.
Bye.
Bye, Lynn.
Jane and Michael Stern's website is roadfood.com. So how about a piece of pie to go with that Iowa coffee? You can find Lynn's Pie in the Sky apple pie on the website, SplendidTable.org. It's time to turn to your calls. Pick up the phone, 800-537-5252. That's what Ben's done. He's in Port Townsend, Washington. Hey, Ben, hi. Do you have a question, sir?
I do. So I live in a nice apartment, but it's got a pretty pathetic little kitchenette
right
area. And I've been trying to figure out different ways to cook lamb. And typically what I do is I'd grill it, but I don't have a grill available, and my oven is pretty dinky. And I was just wondering if you had any advice on ways to cook lamb.
Okay. Do you usually try to do a leg of lamb, or are you up for any kind of cut?
Up for any kind of cut. Typically, if I grill, I'm going to use like a leg or a rack of lamb. But,
right.
I'm pretty much open for anything.
That gets very pricey.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's just so good.
I know. It's really dynamite. You know, I'm just trying to think about what, well, you know, I'll tell you, there are some economical cuts that are really wonderful, and you can do them on a stovetop.
Mm-hmm.
Really delicious, like shoulder chops or
yeah.
Lamb shoulder. You could braise lamb shoulder on the bone or off the bone, and it just is so wonderful. It takes a little fiddling before you get it in the pan. Are you up for that? You know, a little cutting away of fat and that kind of thing?
Oh, yeah. I'm actually, I'm a butcher at a local QOC, so I'm pretty up for that.
Okay. We've just leapfrogged into another world here. Okay, so we want lamb shoulder. You can bone it or not bone it, all right? And
mm-hmm.
and the inspiration... Since we have a little option here, quickly tell me, what flavors do you like? Do you want us to go to India? Do we want to go to the Middle East? Do you want to keep it very, very simple?
Typically with lamb, I like to keep it pretty simple. I have had like a curried lamb, which was interesting. I've never had that before.
Right.
I really like that kind of style, but I also like mostly like just simple, almost like salt and pepper.
I understand. Okay, well, this is what we're going to do with your lamb then. I'd say bone out a shoulder. Do you want to make a fairly large quantity that you can heat up or you can share with friends?
Yeah. This is what I was planning on, either sharing it with friends or taking it for lunch for school.
This would be super. Okay. I'd say, you know, get the amount of lamb you want, but you want boned out shoulder with not all, but some of the most of the fat removed. Okay. And
okay.
Cut it into 1-inch pieces, even a little mm-hmm. larger, because you want it to be able to cook. You want pieces large enough that you can cook it until it's tender, okay? And not that
okay.
it's in such little pieces, it's just going to break apart. And
yeah.
then you want some carrots, and you want onion, and you want maybe some potato if you like potatoes, All right?
Okay.
And then what you're going to do is you're going to take that meat, you're going to brown it in a big skillet with some olive oil. Don't let the pieces touch because they'll stew. All right?
Yeah.
Brown it over medium heat. Take your time. Let it get really brown on all sides. Take it out of the pan. You may have to do it, you know, in a batch or two. All right? Then wipe out the pan completely. Film it with a little more olive oil. Brown some onions in there and brown some carrots. Salt and pepper them as they brown. Throw in a few herbs. You may want some thyme or some rosemary or some basil. Definitely garlic. Then put the vegetables back in the pan. Put the lamb back in the pan. Add some water. Add some wine. Okay? Add some cut up potatoes. Cover the pan. And just let that lamb cook. Don't let it boil. Okay? And just lightly cover it. You can even put loose foil over the pan. Okay? And cook it real slow. You don't want it. You want it barely bubbling. And it can take an hour and a half. It could take 2 hours. You want to stick a thermometer in the meat, and you want it to be at about 160 degrees. And you don't want it to be tough. You want it to be tender but not falling apart. And then you don't eat it right away. You put it in the fridge overnight. And that, and then if the juices aren't really rich tasting, you pull the meat out of the juices, you take the fat off, okay?
Yeah.
And then you boil them down until they're really rich tasting, and you'll have the stew to end all stews. And then if you want to, you could do the same recipe, but you could add curry, you could add cinnamon, you could add, you know, a ton of garlic, you can do whatever you want.
Pretty much do anything. That does sound wonderful.
You are
thank you very much.
You are off and running. And
Thank you.
Good luck with school. Take care.
All right.
Bye, Ben. Okay, it is time for the weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what does the USDA consider a healthy portion of pasta? Well, we're going to be back with that answer in a moment, and you and I are going to talk some more. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. The show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, we're going to be talking with you in a moment, so get in touch, friend us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, send an email, or actually call us, 800-537-5252. But before we talk, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what does the USDA consider a healthy portion of pasta? Well, hang on to your fork. It's 1/2 cup, about 1/16 the amount you'll find in the average bowl of pasta in a restaurant. In fact, for most people, 1/2 cup of pasta is not a portion. It's an afterthought. Now, I'd like to think that this is the size of a side of pasta, where a one-dish meal of pasta has some leeway, and Italians have special dispensation. Okay, back to your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Follow us on Twitter. Connect with us on Facebook. Shoot us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. Hope is on the line from St. Augustine, Florida. Hope, hi. What do you want to talk about?
Okay, well, I have an amazing friend with an amazing garden, and she brought me a huge Ziploc bag of muscadine grapes, and they're really interesting because the outside of them is very firm and the inside is very stringy, and they have a good taste, and apparently there's a lot of fiber in the skin, and a lot of people just squeeze the flesh out and then throw away the skin. But there seems like there's got to be a better way to use them, and she doesn't really have any clues either, so I was like, all right, I know who to call.
Well, I'll tell you. First of all, do you like them?
They're bitter, and the seed part throws me off. But aside from that, I do like them.
Because, you know, there is sometimes there are choices in life. And muscadines can be a tad tricky, you know. All right, let's think about this. First of all, the seeds are not going to be the best thing in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so at one point or another, you're going to have to do some kind of sifting of these babies, and that means you're probably going to lose the skin at the same time.
Right.
But probably the best thing you're going to do with them is cook them in one way or another.
Yeah, I thought of them kind of like a cranberry almost. I could do something like that, make like a glaze of some sort.
That's a really great idea. No, but really it is. And how about doing something like this? How about cooking them with a little bit of red wine?
Okay.
Some honey or, brown sugar.
Okay.
And if you want to get really sexy, there's these great brown sugars from the Caribbean, like Muscovado brown sugar.
Oh, yeah.
It hasn't been treated a lot.
Right.
So it really is a true raw sugar. It hasn't been heavily refined.
Okay.
And it has a great flavor that there's a wildness to muscadine grapes.
Yes, there definitely is.
and Muscovado sugar has that same quality.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
maybe we need to bring the muscadine sexy out then.
Exactly. You're going to bring out it sexy. And if you've got that sugar, forget the red wine. You don't want to, you don't want to get in the way at all. You might want a cinnamon stick in there.
Okay.
And a little bit of water just to get things going. And if you cook that together until the grapes start to break down, then you can put them through a sieve just to, push them through coarse holes, like a sieve with lots of coarse holes. Just to get rid of the tough skin. And you may still have some seeds in there.
Yeah.
You know what you're going to.
Chewing. I can get over that.
Yeah, exactly. And that may be something that you use as a jam. It may be something that you top meats with.
Right.
That kind of thing. You put it on cake. You fill things with it. And it's really delicious.
Hmm.
And if you want to get, fancy, yes, you could actually sieve it so that you lose a lot of the skin and you lose the seeds. But it would really be delicious.
Yeah, most people turn their nose up at these things, apparently, because I couldn't find anything online to do with them. And my friend Beth, she's native to where we live in Florida, and so she's like, I don't care, I've eaten these my whole life. So she just eats them right off the tree, no
big
deal.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that.
Right. But I was like, I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, again, you could also go the red wine, honey, a little bit of spice, a little bit of black pepper, which really works with the slightly wild side of them.
Oh, true.
Yeah. And then what you could do is you make sort of a sauce out of that, a thick, or the mixture between a sauce and almost a jam.
Right.
Right. And then what you do is you get, you put that through a sieve.
Okay.
Okay. And then what you might do is you make a panna cotta. Which is really gelled cream.
Right.
It's slightly sweetened. And just as it's starting to gel in the refrigerator, swirl that through it you marbleize it.
I like that.
Okay. And you're going to keep this a little on the tart side.
Okay.
And that would be really sexy, too.
All right.
I mean, since we're on this theme, I think that would really be nice. And I dare anybody to turn up their nose at that.
All right.
Okay. So
thank you so much.
You're launched. You're launched.
Oh, I've got it from here. Thank you, Lynn.
Okay.
Have a good one.
You too, Hope.
Bye-bye.
800-537-5252. That's how you can reach us by phone. If you go to splendidtable.org, you can send us an email. You can go to Facebook, connect with us there, or you can follow us on Twitter. Tracy is on the line from Cape Cod. Tracy, you are calling from one of my favorite places on earth. What is on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I have a confession to make.
Yeah.
I have to confess to being an obsessive gardener. And so I'm calling you today to find out if you have any additional ideas on what I can do with all of the nasturtium flowers that I have in the garden.
Oh, boy. Well, first of all, give them away. With instructions, because most people look at them and say, but I don't have enough, vases, saucers, et cetera, for these.
Right.
Not realizing you can eat them. I don't know the exact technique, but you're going to find it online. You can preserve them. People do this. They candy violets and they candy all kinds of flowers, rose petals. And there is a method of doing this where... If you pack something in sugar, the sugar draws out the moisture.
Yes.
Just the way salt draws out moisture, you know, in meat.
I do, yeah.
Yeah, and the sugar draws out the moisture. And as I remember, it then replaces the moisture in the petals of the flower. And they're fragile, but I think it can keep the color as well. Okay. Now, I don't know exactly how you go about doing that. But I remember I used to pay a fortune for these babies. Mm. You can get them from France, and you will pay a fortune for them. But you could do this probably with nasturtium flowers.
Oh, that sounds divine. And, of course, the peppery flavor of the flower would counteract sugar beautifully.
Yeah, exactly. I think they're going to be kind of sweet, but they would be beautiful. And, you know, they're used to decorate things. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, that means that all winter long you could be putting them on all kinds of things. So I would look that up. I would look up candying them.
Oh, that's a great idea. I, of course, have done pestos with them.
I'd never thought about that. What does that taste like?
Oh, it was fabulous. Instead of using the pinoli nuts, I used a sunflower seed just to add a little bit of, you know, that a little bit more sweetness to counteract the peppery flavor of the nasturtiums. They get so strong in the late season. And one of the other things that I really love to do with them is to fill them with gorgonzola or a really good blue cheese as an hors d'oeuvre.
What a great idea.
The other thing that I've done with them a great deal is to stuff them, use a piping bag, and fill them with a hummus that's really quite spicy.
Wow.
And that also is lovely. But I'm sort of at the end of my repertoire, so I was hoping you'd come up with
that. I wonder, too, because, you know, the business about frying zucchini flowers. I wonder if you put them in something like a tempura batter,
yes,
because they have such a distinctive taste.
Yes.
I wonder if that wouldn't be wonderful. And then the other thing is, of course, is putting them in frittatas.
Oh.
But a lot of them. No, not none of this, you know, a few thrown into the batter,
right,
into
right,
the egg mix. But I would think a lot of them would be pretty stunning.
Oh, that sounds incredible.
And fold them in toward the end so that color just holds. And that would be pretty wonderful, too, until the season breaks.
Oh, yeah. I knew you would come up with the answer.
Yeah, but you've come up with really, I mean, oh, God, the pesto sounds fabulous.
It's just great.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. All right. Okay, so it's an even exchange, and I'm just going to be thinking about how beautiful it's going to be to see candied nasturtium blossoms.
Oh, I can't wait to see.
Orange and gold and kind of persimmon colors. And
mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. All right, Tracy, I'm now envious and green with jealousy and the whole thing.
I'll think of you tonight as I'm on the beach watching the swallows roost.
Okay.
Thanks,
you got a deal.
Lynn.
Bye.
Bye.
If you've never been to Cape Cod, I'd like to think, and it must be, there are still great stretches of sand and ocean, and you don't see a soul. All right, 800-537-5252. Shoot us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. If you watched the Grammys this year, you saw the Avett brothers burning up the stage, and with them was a guy with swinging black hair doing some wild things with a cello. Well, that cellist was Joe Kwan, and he's become almost as well known for his food blog called Taste on Tour. Joe, nice to talk with you.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
What do you crave when you're on the road?
I would have to say, more than anything, any sort of comfort Asian foods, noodle soups or traditional dishes that my mom made me growing up.
So what's your background?
Korean, born in Korea, raised in High Point, North Carolina.
So, well, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, looking at the way you are with that cello. One of the articles that I read about you, you're referred to as a cello thrasher.
I'm sure my cello teachers of the past would hate to hear that. But.
But there's so much emotion that you throw into your music. Does that carry over to the food?
I would have to say for sure it does. I'm very passionate about eating together and having it be an event. And no matter how big or small the event, it's just as important, you know. Mm-hmm. And if I have friends over, then it's, you know, all around the food, based around the food. So still very passionate about food, and just have to attribute that to my parents, my mom especially, my grandmother, who pretty much raised me growing up and cooking me three meals a day, and still brings back fond memories when I have these traditional dishes.
Did the blog become an extension of that, of sort of reaching out to people?
Yeah, the whole reasoning behind the blog initially was to share my love for food and show people how food really is something that can bring people together. In my family, it brought us together every night for dinner and every weekend with the whole family, and extended family included. And then it only made sense that I would try to find pockets of different types of food from all around the country and all around the world at this point.
Hmm. So what about before a performance? What kinds of foods do you eat before performing? And is there anything you would never eat before a performance?
We have been trained well to never say never. I will say I very rarely will eat anything heavy because it really does affect how light I am on my feet on stage and how I feel. We generally tend to have salads with some sort of protein, I would say 90% of the time. And then the other 10%, if we have time to eat, we'll eat a sandwich, you know, whatever we can grab, some nuts or something. And all of that, usually a couple hours before we actually perform, just so we can settle our stomachs before we hit the stage and jump all over the place like madmen.
So, but now the show is over and you get a chance to go out and really eat whatever you like. What are some of the great finds that you've got?
Oh, man. Some of the interesting dishes that I've come across have been raw lobster tail, which was at this great sushi restaurant in Portland, Maine. There was a place in Columbus, Ohio called North Star Cafe, and I believe there are two locations. And every time we come to Columbus, we always find ourselves ordering the veggie burger from North Star Cafe. We get to Columbus, and we're like, all right, who's making the order? You know, how many veggie burgers are we going to have?
So, you know, I understand that performers have special riders on their contracts of the things that they want to have in their dressing rooms or in the green room.
Mm-hmm.
And it's usually food and drinks.
Oh, you know, we specify only blue M&Ms. And I'm just kidding. We have fresh fruit. Generally, we ask for bananas and apples and orange juice or apple juice, avocados, mixed nuts, about 5 cases of water, I think, and usually cereal and milk, sandwich meats, and peanut butter jelly and bread.
Joe, where's the decadence here? I mean, I'm expecting Cristal, foie gras, you know, caviar, and you want cereal and you want the milk.
Yeah, we try to be as low impact and as friendly as possible so people will ask us back.
Joe, thanks for talking with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Joe Kwan is cellist with the Avett Brothers and blogs about food at Taste on Tour. Well, that's the show for this week. You can connect with us any way you want. Call us, 800-537-5252. Follow us on Twitter. Join us on Facebook. Send an email, splendidtable.org. And until next week, let me leave you with this from Robert Fripp. Music is the wine that fills the cup of silence. Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Now, you're going to find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. Browse our recipes, our online store, sign up for our weekly e-newsletter and special podcasts, and take a look at our new book, How to Eat Weekends. Check it out. That's splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson and Mary Beth Leone Getton. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The website is managed by Sarah Lear. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
American Public Media.